Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for March 28, 2019, the month of March. Ripped that off the calendar page and moving on next week into April. Here's an interesting story. NASA, this coming Friday, was going to have the first women, I believe there were two of them, scheduled for the space shuttle to do a spacewalk outside of the space shuttle, and this would be the first time women were allowed to do spacewalks. Now, something tells me that isn't a correct story, because I have seen before, in fact, there was a woman who, in fact, was instrumental in the space shuttle that went up to fix the Hubble Space Telescope. Remember when the Hubble Space Telescope was first launched? This was like in, you know, in the 80s or something. The mirrors were wrong. Kodak, there was some kind of infighting between Kodak, who was making the mirrors, and other businesses or co-partners, whatever. And the mirrors were ground to the wrong formula. Now, remember, there was a rather humorous cartoon in a newspaper. This cartoonist drew a picture of the Hubble Space Telescope taking a picture of people down, like, on the street in the United States. And their faces were all distorted, but clearly angry. It was a very cute cartoon, but, you know, implying that they were angry over all of the money for the space telescope, and it was made incorrectly. But anyway, at that time when the astronauts went up and had to fix the space telescope, is my understanding there was a woman doing a spacewalk at that time. So anyway, the actual story is that this would be the first time that women, a complete crew of women, this pair of women, would do a spacewalk in apparently they're doing some installation of equipment on the space station, but it'd be the first time a pair of women went out of the space station together. And so this is not the space shuttle. That was a different, vehicle. These women get to the U.S. space station on a Russian rocket, on a Russian launch. But anyway, I thought it was interesting that they had these two women scheduled to go out together, but didn't have the proper spacesuits planned. So a little oopsie-doopsie there at the last minute. By the way, ma'am, you don't have a spacesuit to wear, so I guess you can't go walking out in space. Oh, okay, well, I guess not. Anyway, in the news, this topic keeps coming back, and I keep talking about it. Now, this is a topic that I talked about before anybody really had a handle on this. And I talked about diamonds in space being created in the sunward side of comets. And there was evidence a number of years ago that there were rings of diamonds, like Saturn-type rings, discovered around other star systems. And so the only thing that could give off this light pattern, spectroscopic light pattern, would be diamonds. Now they're finding vast clouds of diamonds in outer space. But these are nano diamonds. These are extremely small diamonds. And they have the interesting property that they have a hydrogen compound coating on top of them. So the hydrogen compounds, of course, are in that probably just a single layer on top of a nano diamond is enough to give a signature, a spectroscopic signature, but not enough to block the properties of the they call them diamonds. They're carbon structures, carbon crystalline structures, which is a diamond. And so anyway, that's very interesting that this keeps popping up in the news. And so, as I've said before, there were experiments that were done a long time ago where they created diamonds in a laboratory. And the way they did this was by taking carbon, a block of pure carbon material, vaporizing it in a vacuum chamber, and then putting in an electrical current of electrons. And this gave the impetus for these like buckyball structures of carbon to form. And of course, carbon is an eight-sided atom. So when they go into covalent bonding, they do quite well with other carbon atoms, not real well with other types of atoms. Of course, you have various types of organic molecules that include carbon. But the hardest and most stable structures of carbon are in the form of inorganic structures, crystalline structures, diamond being the hardest. And it's actually transparent, which is very interesting, because most of the carbon forms are not transparent. In fact, if you have, for example, carbon dioxide ice, if you freeze carbon dioxide, it forms a white, kind of like frosty type of ice where it's opaque. So, and that's a solid, another solid form of carbon dioxide ice. We call it dry ice because it's colder. When it changes from the ice form, it goes directly into gas. And so you see it giving off. But unlike water ice, which leaves the water after it melts and gives you, like if you have a cooler, leaves you with this sloppy mess in the bottom of your cooler. So anyway, be that as it may, the reason for diamonds in outer space are because they form in the electrical currents, the electron current on the nose side of comets, in its exact same environment as the chamber, the laboratory vacuum chamber, where they, in fact, can make carbon diamond structures. But as I said, interesting that these nano diamonds have a hydrogen compound on the surface, and that's basically the only thing it can be. So that, once again, this keeps popping up in the news every now and then. So it's why I keep bringing it back. But it also begs the question of the standard idea that diamonds form down deep in the earth and somehow they come up during volcanic activity, and that's where diamonds come from. That's the standard theory. And like just about everything out there, it's wrong. I mean, it couldn't possibly be true, because when you think about it, to form a diamond, which is the hardest material, you would have to, by pressure that is, you would have to have a material on the two sides of the diamond that are harder than diamond. Since diamond is the hardest material in the environment down deep in the earth, there's no way a diamond can form because it is the hardest material. It's not going to be compressed more than the ability of the material around it to compress in the diamond material. And so it's impossible to form a diamond by compression with material that is less dense, less structurally sound than diamond, than the carbon lattice that we call a diamond. Impossible. Let alone make a big one. So big diamonds forming in outer space. And the whole reason for the buckyball structure is that's where the strength comes from. As the diamond crystal forms inside, it has a very strong structure surrounding it to create the pressure that's necessary. And the other thing that happens is the diamonds then build up, and this is similar also, I talk about this in my book Calculate Primes, and I talk about it in the Diamond Principle also, where the crystalline structures of snowflakes, for example, form also in an electric field. Okay, just a little side note here. Now, 24/7 on all the news media channels, you have probably been listening to the fallout from the Mueller investigation. that there was no collusion found for the Trump campaign, nor Trump, nor anybody in his group, nor for any American. So this false narrative that's been ringing from the highest church steeples around the country and around the world for the last 2.5 to 3 years, it actually started prior to the election, the 2016 election, a complete false narrative. And of course, you can tell, you can smell this a mile away, and the American people did. But the thing that's interesting now is, of course, there's going to be some actual investigations that go to try and find out where this began, and that's going to dig up a lot of dirt. But I thought the one quip here that I thought's worth noting that I didn't hear anybody else talk about was that Jim Clapper, the very high up in security, national security in the United States under Obama, said on camera this last week when he was trying to stumble for words, he said that the president, meaning Obama, directed them to do this investigation, and then he says to hand this off to the incumbent president, which is ludicrous. I mean, just making this up. But the funny part is he pointed the finger directly at Obama directing this basically militarization, politicization of the intelligence agencies to do an investigation on Trump. But of course, the whole purpose was to get information, because Trump was clearly, the people that really knew that Trump was going to win the election. And so they were desperate. They were going to do anything they could to make him lose, because he wasn't a Washington man. He was not a party man. He was not a European banker-owned man. And they really didn't want this guy around, and the American people were going for the Trump message. So whether you like it or not, that's what was happening. But Clapper said in public that Obama directed them to do this whole thing, which was one of the big questions before. Here's an interesting story. Southwest Airlines was moving one of its Boeing 737 MAX 8 airplanes from Florida to Los Angeles. Now, I don't know why they would be flying this, but anyway, one of the engines quit, and they had problems. But this was an airplane belonging to Southwest Airlines. Now, why they're taking off with one of these airplanes, and they said, oh, well, there were no passengers aboard. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, they had pilots aboard. They had, those pilots are people too. And so these planes should not have been in the air at all. It should have never taken off, especially from a commercial airline and going to another commercial or a commercial runway and going to another commercial runway. That's absurd. So it really makes you wonder what these people are thinking. What is Southwest Airlines thinking, moving a MAX 8 Boeing 737, taking off from a runway when that plane was grounded? That plane was grounded. It should have never taken off. Here's a story about India shoots down a low Earth orbit satellite. So India puts up a satellite and then goes up and shoots it down. And of course, China has done this. Russia has the technology. Now India, it's basically a shotgun in outer space. You just coming, you know, these things are moving at 17,000 miles an hour. And if you're coming in the opposite direction, double that, like 34,000 miles an hour, all you got to do is throw some BBs, anything, small metal pieces in a shotgun pattern, and you hit that satellite, it's going to blow it to pieces. So compare it to, like, say, a 50 caliber machine gun, you know, and the amount of impact. There's no satellite ever made that would withstand being shot with a 50 caliber machine gun at close range. The the spray, the material coming in at 34,000 miles an hour would dwarf the impact of a 50 caliber machine gun. I mean, this is just going, whatever it hits, it's just going to absolutely destroy it. And the point is that these are very simple weapons, and you could claim that they're offensive weapons, or the people could also claim that they would be defensive weapons, because if they were, say, fearing, and of course the United States was the one that started this, preemptive strikes. If you think somebody's going to strike you, you have the right to go strike them. So the gloves are off, in other words. But this technology is very, very simple. India, once again, proving this. So the entire point here is the American military depends heavily on its satellite fleet. And it would be very difficult to, if say, a rocket were launched from someplace in Earth, or a dozen rockets, and the purpose of those rockets was to go up and, say, destroy the GPS satellites of Earth, or the Hubble Space Telescope, or telecommunications satellites, or satellites that do, like, satellite TV, direct TV, or whatever. It would be very easy to take these out in an afternoon, and there's nothing that anybody could do about it, and there would be no place to readily replace these. So anyway, this is, I don't know exactly how to interpret this, other than India now has this technology, and it's just a matter of time until they perfect it to be able to take out any satellite. And as I said, it'd be very hard to defend against, because a rocket being launched from someplace on Earth and coming back into the atmosphere, well, there are such things as anti-ballistic missile systems, and they really have never, ever worked. But a target out in outer space, there's literally no defense of any kind. And if you say you had a some kind of a anti-satellite missile that you could go up and try and knock down this particular missile, all it has to do is, before it gets hit, just let that shrapnel go. And the GPS satellites, the other telecommunication satellites, are not mobile. They're parked. They have a very little bit of fuel to position them and keep them in position for a period of 10 to 15 years. But they really don't have the fuel to maneuver very far. So anyway, and if they did, they would lose their ability to communicate. So either way, they would be rendered as disabled. Interesting that this technology is now in the hands of India. And here's a story. New York bans unvaccinated kids. Now, this is a county that's New York County, and I understand another county, where there are measles outbreaks. And I just wonder if these are fabricated. They're claiming that this was initiated by a person that went to Israel and came back and brought the measles virus from Israel and then spread it around, primarily in Jewish communities around the New York area. Just to talk about the numbers here, there's 153 cases. Now, there's a couple of points here. First of all, they're going around door to door in New York, knocking on doors saying, you got to get your kids vaccinated, or they're not going to be allowed to go into public places. And people are getting really irritated. The real solution here is to quarantine the people that have the measles. This is something that is very clear. Instead of mass injecting vaccinations into the public, you quarantine the few people that are known to have this. And then you quarantine the people that they've been in contact with. It's a very closed community where this is allegedly spreading. So 153 cases is really not that many when you look at a population of about 15 to 20 million people around the New York City area. But their solution is to vaccinate everybody and go door to door, pounding on doors, demanding that people become vaccinated. It's not a popular solution, and it's not a realistic solution, because if you get an injection for measles or mumps or rubella or whatever, those shots don't take effect for a long period of time. And so the end result is that vaccinations really are not a solution. Quarantine has been the universal solution since the beginning of time, and it's always worked. It's a method. In fact, I've talked about this before, that when I was a kid, when somebody would get one of these like so-called diseases, the parents would bring the other kids over, so they got it too, so they would all build up immunity. And so it was understood that that's how the body became immune. And for the kids who did not have these diseases as kids, when they grew up and they got them, it was far worse. And that's where things like rickets and other adult diseases come from. These are very serious complications that occur when people are older and get these. I knew a woman who was always, her and her husband were always very active when they were even getting older. And she came down with rickets because she had held a little kid that had chicken pox, and she had never had chicken pox. And so she ended up getting rickets, a very debilitating disease, because she did not have that when she was a little girl. Now, earlier in the show, I was talking about diamonds and diamond structures. And so I'm going to go into a discussion here on chemistry. In fact, in chemistry, dealing with items in outer space or in various forms. For example, ice. If water is in the liquid form, the covalent bonding and the hydrogen bonding act differently than when they're in the frozen state. And the very interesting thing here is that given the atmospheric pressure, given the conditions that we find on Earth, no matter where you go and you look at ice molecules and water molecules and ice structure, what you find is it's the same. Now, there, you know, in a chunk of ice, say a block of ice, if you take a block of ice on a table, 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot, there's, you know, unbelievable number of molecules of water in that chunk of ice. They all act the same. So you have to ask yourself, is this some result of completely random particle assemblage that happened after a big bang that was totally chaotic and had no organization at all? And the answer is very clearly no. You couldn't even imagine seeing this kind of organization and then imagining that somehow this was simply random. And then you look at something like as complicated as, say, human life or the life of any type of embryonic development, where basically out of information that's coded in a molecular structure that this living entity comes out, whether it's an amoeba or a human being, the information comes out. And, you know, when you look at an amoeba, you go, oh, that's an amoeba. You look at a human, you go, that's a human. And there's very interesting components of the structure. Like you see these cartoons for kids with a single eye. The little characters have a single eye in the middle of their forehead. Well, that's maybe cute for little kids. I don't know really why they're doing that or if there's some agenda with that. You know, but kids are little kids are little kids. But in reality, there's really no system on Earth that looks like that. From the time you get to any complication at all, you have a symmetry, a bilateral symmetry. In other words, you have two eyes, two nostrils, symmetric mouth, with the same number of teeth on the right side as the left side. They're shaped the same, or, you know, certainly there's variations in, say, tooth structure, etc. And two ears, you know, your brain is even separated symmetrically down the middle. And so there's something inherent about the genetic code that brings about a symmetry. Is this random? Would you expect this from a random series of events? And the answer is no. There is structure here. There's planning. There's, on my paid cast, I had a series of lectures where I talked about organic molecules and inorganic molecules. And of course, the question is, what makes an organic molecule organic? And if you ask any chemist, they're going to look at you like you're the man from Mars, because they don't know. But see, what they're going to do is they're going to say, see, this is the pat answer. This is like the pretend you're smart but really aren't answer. Is that, oh, well, organic molecules, this is literally the definition. If you look up the dictionary definition of an organic molecule, they are the molecules that have to do with life. Well, that's a pretty strange definition. It would be like saying, what's a tire? Oh, well, a tire is the things that go on there's four of them on a car. It was like, wait a minute. That doesn't explain, it doesn't tell me much about the tire. It tells me where the tire is used and where we see tires most of the time on cars, but it doesn't tell me anything about the tire or how it was made or why it works or anything else. Or why all tires look alike, you know, where did they come from? There was a mold, so that a certain set of tires, if you buy four tires, they're the same, you know. It's the same thing with organic molecules. Saying that an organic molecule is a molecule that has to do with life is not a definition. It doesn't tell you anything about organic molecule or why organic molecules have anything to do. Why are they different? Why do these molecules that are organic build up systems that can store energy and be used at the will of the organism versus inorganic molecules like a crystalline structure of carbon, which we call diamond? Why are those called inorganic? Because carbon can make up carbon dioxide, which in a sense, it's called an organic molecule because it has oxygen and carbon. But in its own right, a carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide molecule is not a living entity. It can't store up energy and use it at will. It acts like an inorganic molecule. And so the very interesting thing, going back to water, is that if you go to the far side of the universe, and this is one of the opening points in my book, The Diamond Principle, I use in that book the example of the diamond. But getting a little closer to home, if you take a water molecule and you look at its structure on the far side of the universe, it's going to exactly act like a water molecule that we find on Earth. Not like just any a few or a small sampling, but all of them work the same. So if you took a water molecule from Earth and you took it to the far side of the universe and you put it with water molecules that you found there and you put it into a water block, it would, and then froze that water block, it would act just like a block of ice that you had here. And if you took a water molecule from the far side of the universe and brought it here and put it into a water block and then froze that block into a block of ice, it would act the same as the water molecule that you took from here and took to the other side of the universe. So for people to say and try and pawn off this idea that evolution just did this and this is just random and that there's no structure or order here, and that there's no design, you'd have to be a really, really, really bad scientist or mathematician to even come close to such a ridiculous conclusion, you know, or to believe that evolution brought organisms up to the state where they are today. We see changes. In fact, every offspring is different than its parents. So change is something we see. It's really, you know, but to imagine that then that implies that there's no order in the universe and all this is happening at random is an impossible stretch. Okay, so let me go through this again. Talking about organic molecules being the basis of life, etc., it's a non-definition. It's a terrible definition. It doesn't explain, and that's why I go back to this point, that if you went out and asked the best organic chemist on the planet, one that's won 2 or 3 Nobel Prizes for amazing work, you know, dealing with organic chemistry, and you asked them the simplest question, what makes an organic molecule organic? And at what point does the carbon dioxide molecule that becomes associated, for example, in your body, and then combined, or say an oxygen or a water molecule, and all of a sudden that becomes part of this living, breathing thing that has decision-making power, and your decisions can be different than mine, and I can be happy with something, and the same thing will make you sad or feel bad. Where does evolution explain this? So anyway, the point I'm trying to get at here is that there is an amazing design in the universe. And when you look at the properties of water, just the properties of water, that it has a certain balance in the liquid state of a balance of charge, and that balance of charge is offset. The oxygen molecule has more propensity to be charged than the 2 hydrogen. It's a covalent bond, but then the water molecules have other types of bonding, like hydrogen bonding, which is very weak. But it's the combination of these properties that give water very interesting properties. For example, when water freezes, it has a different dimension than when it's in the water state. And these are very powerful forces. My uncle once told me, he went to engineering school at, I believe it was one of the branches of the University of Minnesota, and as a engineering experiment, they took a big steel ball, like a foot in diameter, and it was a ball bearing from a big machine. So this is a giant ball bearing, like a foot in diameter. And they drilled a hole down into the center, and then they tapped it so that they could put a bolt down all the way, so that there was just a little teeny space in the middle when they put the bolt all the way in, which was well sealed. And okay, so you have this steel ball, basically, that once you put the bolt in, it's back to the being the state of a sealed, hard, you know, completely a steel ball. And so they took a drop of water and they put it down in the middle of this steel ball bearing, a foot in diameter, and they froze it. And the freezing, the expansion of the water when it was frozen, was enough to crack that steel ball. That's how much force is involved there. And imagine a diamond, which has much more force, much stronger covalent bonding. But water has the property that it changes dimensions when it crosses that freezing point. Then they took another ball, a similar steel ball, did the same thing, drilled a hole, put the bolt in. And this time when they put the water in the middle, they brought it up to steam. They brought the ball up to a temperature where it was above the boiling point of water. So the water turned to steam. Also, that cracked the ball. That's how much force. That's why steam engines were very popular for a long time because the tremendous amount of expansive force in water. In fact, the Stanley Steamer, I happened to visit the area where the Stanley Steamer was produced. It's out in like Montana. It's up in the glacier area of Montana. I went on a trip one time, and the Stanley Steamer factory happened to be up there. But the beautiful thing about the Stanley Steamer was that you could burn anything. You could put wood or coal or, I mean, whatever you had handy. You put water and fuel in there, and it, you had a pretty nice vehicle. It would go, you know, it would cheap fuels, you know, water, and of course out there you had plenty of wood. So the Stanley Steamer was a pretty nice vehicle, and of course it didn't really become a big success because they wanted petroleum as the fuel for automobiles. In fact, if you're not aware of it, electric vehicles were commonplace around the early 1900s. Porsche had an electric vehicle. And if reason had prevailed, we would all be driving electric vehicles right now. Anyway, that's another story. So anyway, back to the idea of molecules, molecular structures. And so I was just talking about water specifically. But you could take any other chemical structure, or iron, for example. When it oxidizes, it turns to basically what we call rust. And, of course, water facilitates that process. So when you take iron out of the ground, the raw product, the iron ore, you have to get rid of that oxygen to get this, and then to get the metal, which then you mix with other metals to create steel. So anyway, I'm going to switch gears a little bit here and talk about recycling. Now, we all live in a world of recycling where we're conscious not to throw aluminum cans in the gutter. But is there recycling in the universe? And this is a key question, because if we have a universe that did not have a beginning, if there was no Big Bang, which there wasn't, then what the heck is going on? What's the universe doing? Just quickly, for those people that still believe in the Big Bang, which never happened, but here's basically the issue. What is the evidence? What got the whole idea of the Big Bang going, that there would be the beginning of the universe? In a sense, there have always been two camps, so to speak. One, steady-state universe, where the universe just continues and continues. And, of course, in that case, you need recycling. The processes have to be reversible to some degree, and oxidation is one of those reversible processes where iron, for example, is formed in the stellar processes, and then it has to revert back to, in a natural form in, say, planet Earth, it's in the form of iron oxide, and then it can be smelted, and you can get rid of the oxygen, and that becomes, with mixed with other types of metal, it becomes steel. But then, as we say, Mother Nature takes this back. You see an old rusting car. If you just left a car or some piece of steel out unprotected in the environment, it would not be very long at all. Certainly in a couple thousand years, not much would be left at all. In fact, the wind would take the iron and iron oxide and blow it around. People that live in iron-rich areas are very aware of that red. It's everywhere. It's a red powder, and it blows around, and it gets in everything that you own. Your clothes, your shoes, your socks, your water, everything. It's everywhere. So, at any rate, what a, back to the issue of the Big Bang. The issue is that when the Big Bang started, it was because Edwin Hubble, saw redshifts every place he looked. He was one of the first people to have good spectroscopic equipment and good telescopes, the kind that were large enough to where they actually began to resolve galaxies. Although we have a neighbor galaxy, and it was just called like a cloud. They really didn't know what it was, but then it became clear that it was a galaxy, like all those other millions of galaxies. Now there are billions of galaxies. Not to quote my my enemy in science, Carl Sagan, but billions of galaxies. And so anyway, when they first saw these and took spectroscopic analysis of these, they were all redshifted. The light coming from them was shifted to the red, which, according to special relativity, meant that they were moving away. And of course, then they discovered quasars that had very high redshifts, and then the whole issue of general relativity being included, and the cosmology as you can smell it today with the Big Bang and the other supporting evidence. Somebody came along and said, well, if there was a Big Bang, there should be some kind of residual effect, and that would be in the form of microwave radiation coming from all directions in space. So they put up some satellites that could measure microwaves, and lo and behold, they discovered microwaves coming from all directions in space. However, that has many twists and turns in that the results were not what they predicted. Anyway, that is the short version. I could go on and on about that. But number one, the redshift is not due to the distance or things moving away from us. The redshifts are due to internal properties of the galaxies, which I have discovered. It's called the induced electric dipole redshift. So it's a property of stars that is a result of the fusion process, the separation of charge, and when the light leaves our own sun, produces a redshift, and it's not moving away at the speed of light. At any rate, then the other thing, the microwave background radiation, is a result of the nebular ion cloud that surrounds our star, the sun, and that's what they're measuring. They're measuring the microwave radiation that comes from that cloud, which is in our local solar environment. It's not from the Big Bang. So anyway, the Big Bang is a hoax. It's like there's other scientific hoaxes out there. But one of them also is that the fusion is at the core of the sun. That's a hoax. And these are scientific things that came along. They seemed like a good explanation at the time. And then people hang their hat on it. And at that point, you can't get rid of them because it is assumed that everything in the respectable peer-reviewed journals is correct. Well, it's correct by popular vote, not because of real science. Once you get something in there, you can't get it out. And that's where we stay today with science, is we're dealing with theories that were proposed before the 1950s, long before there was any spacecraft, long before there was any real decent equipment, long before they knew about the solar wind, on and on and on. So anyway, coming back to recycling, if there was no Big Bang, which there wasn't, then the other option is that the universe, one proposal is that the Big Bang happened everywhere. There was, you know, it wasn't just a point, as the Big Bang people, cosmologists say. They say, there was a Big Bang every place, and all matter just came into being. Just magically, there it was. And, of course, this is atheistic science. They need to come up with something that does not require a creator or an initiator or whatever. And in our small human minds, we need to resolve things. It's like, here's a good example. In the human psyche, every television show lasts 1 hour, and at the end of that hour, whether it's the crime TV series, whether it's the comedy TV series, they all have to have some kind of resolution at the end of 1 hour. Music is the same. The average song is 3 to 5 minutes, the average modern song. If they're longer, they become like, you know, very unusual. And like when the, anyway, I won't go into specifics. But the human mind needs resolution. And if it doesn't get resolution, if you listen to a song that was going along, they were talking about, all of a sudden they stopped, you'd go, well, wait a minute, they didn't finish the song. It's somehow inbred into the human mind that there has to be a resolution. And one of those resolutions is that there had to be some kind of beginning. And I liken this to a guy that walks in the forest. Walks in the forest and looks around and has never been in a forest before. Lived in the city all his life, goes to the forest. There's big trees, there's little trees, there's little sprouting trees. There are trees that are falling down with fungus growing and they're rotting. There's leaves that have fallen and are decaying on the forest floor. And you see this forest in all of this state. And then somebody comes up and says, how did this forest begin? You go, what? Well, you're just looking at the forest. You know, how can you make a determination of how this began? You just walked into it today. Well, that's the cosmological situation. And, of course, astronomers are some of the most arrogant people around. They consider themselves, in fact, the astronomers say this, it's the most godlike of sciences because they study the stars. Well, you could also say that of people that study, you know, subatomic particles. It's, in fact, they have a particle called the God particle. They have the, they put themselves up on a lofty pillar above everybody else. And, of course, they get to the point where they believe they have determined where the universe came from. And believe me, at this point in our very modest beginning as a intelligent species, we're nowhere near understanding. They can't take that question and just put it over there on the shelf and say, we don't know enough yet to answer that question. Nope. The arrogant astronomers have to jump up and down and beat the drum and say it began in a big bang, and they put a date on it. They're always refining that date, getting closer and closer to the date of the Big Bang. It's all garbage. It's all psychological fanfare because astronomers have to act smart like they know what's going on. But the reality is, in doing so, in jumping at conclusions too quickly, they made big, big, big mistakes. So back to the original story, if there was no Big Bang, which there wasn't, then what's going on? So we have to look at recycling processes. As a galaxy grows, it is accumulating dust and gases, brings them in, spits them out into the twin arm system. And my paper on galaxies, which is peer-reviewed, by the way, and in an astrophysics journal, talks about the formation of galaxies, and it starts out with a 2 or 3 star system, and then all of the other planets come at a later date. So possibly Saturn was with Jupiter and our sun as the original system, but everything else came later by capture. Okay, so that's a process of assimilation. The galaxy forming, assimilating material, starting the star systems go out, start accumulating material. But then what happens to this star system at the end? Well, we have a thing called exploding galaxies, where galaxies, after they accumulate a certain amount of material, explode. And so this is the recycling process. So the universe is in a recycling process. So it's like walking into the woods in the cosmological sense, seeing everything going on, but still the human mind, and this is one of the main points, the human mind needs that resolution. Well, if it's recycling and going on for ever and ever, it had to have a beginning someplace. It had to have had a beginning. Well, in our human mind, that being part of a recycling process is not exactly a satisfactory answer. But it's very interesting that in the design of all of this complexity and the immense amount of material that goes into the universe, there is this minuscule, absolutely just beyond understanding, minuscule amount of material that goes into making intelligent beings. So that's something that's very interesting. But the whole issue here is that literally we don't have enough information to make an informed decision, and we have to understand that our human minds are, number one, very limited. We have, number two, very limited information. And really, thirdly, the human mind, this issue that we need immediate resolution. It's like the Bic pen syndrome, where you use it, you throw away, and you grab another one. And the recent issue, whether you like this or not, the whole issue of collusion, for example, where people get something in their minds, or like global warming. They get it in their mind and they cannot. That's the world. That's the truth. They read. How many people are not even good scientists? They're just normal people walking up and down the street, and they repeat endlessly global warming, which is a myth. The greenhouse effect didn't work 30 years ago. This is why they don't talk about the greenhouse effect anymore, because it has scientifically been disproven that somehow there's a greenhouse effect on a carbon dioxide or methane-laden atmosphere. Venus has an atmosphere thousands of times denser than Earth, with pure carbon dioxide almost, and it does not have a greenhouse effect. So how can the greenhouse effect work on Earth? And the issue here is that a greenhouse has a glass, literally a glass barrier, that prevents heat from leaving. The CO2 in the atmosphere is not a glass ceiling. And the heat can leave. It leaves readily every day. The other issue with global warming is that the nuclear power plants, the coal plants, the natural gas power plants, your automobile produce millions of times more heat right now immediately than the greenhouse effect, which would occur in 20 years. It's absurd. It's so absurd, it's beyond absurd. And this is what it's like in cosmology. People have gotten the Big Bang in their head. They have gotten the idea of redshift and, microwave background radiation. There are all kinds of problems with the microwave background radiation. It changes. There should not be a change. If this happened billions of years ago and left this microwave background radiation signature, it should not be changing on a year-to-year basis, but it does, because they're not looking at something that came from the Big Bang. They're looking at a cloud of material that's around our solar system, and it changes. But the scientists don't talk about it. They go back and they tell the theorists, and the theorists go, oh, well, now we're going to create the bubble theory. Now we're going to create the modified bubble theory. Whatever the data says, they're going to come up with something that's Big Bang-ish about it, because their brains are locked in this. And it's being a scientist and seeing scientists do this, and you go land on a comet nucleus, and that's a good example of recycling. That's the building up process, part of the building up process. But we've landed on the nucleus of a comet. There's no ice, there's no water, there's no snow, there's nothing coming off of it. It's made of carbon-rich organic molecules, carbon, nitrogen-rich organic molecules. There's no water there, yet they still say it's a dirty snowball. You know, this is a psychological problem with science and scientists, because they can't say something against the published peer-reviewed journals. It's a religion. It's not science. It's exactly like when Galileo dropped the two different sized lead balls off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and they both hit the ground at the same time. The professors that were witnessing this and the students, they had to go back to the classroom, and the professors continued teaching Aristotelian physics that said that the bigger ball should hit first. And Galileo proved through observation that that was not the case, yet they continued teaching it. So this is a problem with the human mind. It's a problem with educated people are the worst, by far the worst. I've always said that. That the more education somebody has, the worse it is. And this is a real psychological problem. But when these people are in charge of the funding, the use of equipment, very expensive equipment that you paid for, this cycle continues. It's a travesty of science and the use of public trust. So anyway, that's back to the issue of recycling. The universe is recycling. We have to look for recycling processes. And that should be the concentration of science, not building, say, the James Webb Telescope, which is a boondoggle in itself, but building telescopes. And what do they say? Oh, this will help us understand how the universe began 4.5 billion years ago. They already are proclaiming what they're going to discover because that meets with their narrative. At any rate, but recycling is a key issue. Just a couple quick things. The College Gate trials are going on right now. I would suggest you follow that. Just a huge scam where universities, and there's a lot more going on than just this. That's the problem. And then also Brexit coming. I always said this, as if Mrs. May is still prime minister, UK will Brexit. You know, she's trying to find a happy medium. There is no happy medium. They voted to get out of the European Union. They're going to do it. Just remember also my sales page, that I don't have donations. I don't have government grants. The only support I get is from you buying my water filter products, book products, etc. on my webpage, jmccsci.com. Remember, I have the new MR7 whole house water filter. It's on sale there, and you get a big deduction on the replacement filter packs if you buy them with the original unit. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.